Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
The tales we tell ourselves don't always reveal the whole story. When parents in Gardendale, Alabama, had the idea to secede from the Jefferson County School District, they talked about wanting schools that served what they saw as their community, people they socialized and went to church with, and who could be counted on to contribute financially to the school. The mini district they proposed achieved just that by drawing lines that put low-income students of color outside district boundaries. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Alvin Chang is a reporter at Vox. He notes that this phenomenon has been happening in many parts of the country. And while affluent families rarely mention race, the effect of this kind of public school redistricting is unmistakable, concentrating white kids in small islands of privilege carved out of larger districts where the population is significantly less white and less wealthy. You can find a link to his article, School Segregation Didn't Go Away, It Just Evolved, at think.kera.org. He joins us this hour from the studios of NPR in New York City. Alvin, welcome back to Think.
Yeah, it's really good to be here.
How does this happen? How do district lines get drawn and redrawn to carve out wealthier areas, wider areas from larger districts?
I think it's important to make the point that this was a very expected evolution of school segregation. We like to think of school segregation as something of the past, something that went away after Brown v. Board of Education integrated schools. But actually, that was just the start of the story. And I want to go back to the 1930s, where the Federal Housing Authority was granting loans, backing housing loans to American homeowners. But they had in their guidelines that they were not going to grant loans to black families. And that meant that black families were not moving into these nicer neighborhoods. That meant that black families were stuck in what are essentially ghettos. But another part of that was the Federal Housing Authority started granting suburban development loans to start suburbs. And what they did was they said, you guys can create these suburbs, but you can't let black families live there. Otherwise, we're going to pull the backing. So essentially, you have black families who can't live in the suburbs, who can't live in the nice neighborhoods in the cities, who are stuck in ghettos. And then integration kicks in. Brown v. Board kicks in. The Fair Housing Act kicks in. But instead of integration, you get this this well-trodden path of white families leaving for the suburbs. It's the white flight that we always talk about. And certain parts of the city stay pretty segregated because these black families weren't able to accrue wealth. And then school boards start to draw school zones that perpetuate school segregation. There's an incredible case in Detroit where they drew the school line that particularly cut out the black neighborhoods and put them in their own zone and cut out the white neighborhoods and put them in their own zones. And so you have this situation where black families are put into a certain area. White families have a path to leave if black families want to integrate. And so we have this this situation ripe for confrontation. And that's exactly what happened in Detroit in a 1970s case called Milliken v. Bradley, where the Detroit School Board wanted to integrate schools, but the parents didn't. And so after a huge outrage, they were afraid it would, when they were allowed to bus students from one neighborhood to another, that case went to the Supreme Court. And because of a fear of more white flight, because, you know, if you can start busing white students into the black neighborhood and black students into the white neighborhood, a lot of the white families might leave and that might trigger more white flight. So the NAACP had this idea of starting to bus suburban kids into the city and city kids out into the suburbs. So you would kind of include a larger community of people so you couldn't just escape to the suburbs, put a border between you and people you don't want to be around and create your own district or be in your own district. But the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You can't involve these suburban communities in your integration efforts. And now we have the system where if you don't want to be around a certain group of people, you can put a border between you and them, and you, you know, especially if you're in a suburb, a predominantly white suburb, then you can just escape to the other side of the border. But, you know, now these parents are getting creative and they're starting to say, well, what if we don't want to move? What if we just take our community in this area and create our own borders? And so that's the exact situation that's happening in Gardendale, Alabama, and 71 other communities since the year 2000 have tried this, and most of them have succeeded.
Yeah, one that has not come to fruition actually was in a neighborhood in North Texas here in Lakewood. At least people were talking about it. You call this the most brazen modern example of privileged groups trying to separate themselves from other people. That's a strong statement.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's brazen about it is you're taking what is a social contract you've had with the people around you, with your neighbors. It's a social contract where you say we will sacrifice for the greater good when we are successful, and we will receive help from the community when we need that help. And it's something that I think this country was built on. But now you have people saying, well, actually, these people, you know, whether they tend to be poorer and tend to be people of color, these people are not part of our community. And then they use this coded language to say, and here's our localism argument. Here's why they're not part of our community. You know, there's a quote that was on a Facebook page in Gardendale when they were organizing the secession. There's a quote where one guy says, our churches look like our community, but our schools don't. And that's coded in to say, these are the people that we want in our community, that we want to share resources with, and these are the people that we don't. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to move for you. We're going to draw a border and, you know, wall ourselves in.
And Gardendale is the eighth neighborhood to pull away from the larger school district in Jefferson County, Alabama.
Yeah, I recommend everyone to go and Google Gardendale School District borders or, you know, Jefferson County School District borders. So Jefferson County School District is the school district that was the county-based district. Most southern states tend to have county-based school districts. But when you look at the borders, it looks like a Lego formation, or it looks like it's pixelated. Something's wrong there. And there's little enclaves cut out of squares and blocks and little roads cut out. And it's very clear this is a gerrymandering of a school district to suit the needs of a privileged class of people who want to create these borders for themselves. And Gardendale is, you know, is the eighth, but seven others have succeeded before. Hmm. And you can start seeing the district that's left behind starting to suffer because of it. Long before Gardendale.
Yeah, I'm wondering what happens to the tax base available to the larger school district that has now been stripped of students of greater means.
It's you're both taking away the wealthiest people in the district, and taking their tax money, walling it up, and creating a moderately wealthy district on its own, while making a poor population even poorer, a disadvantaged population, and taking away resources even further from them. And what's really interesting is these districts where secessions happen aren't these very wealthy areas. They tend to be middle class. They tend to have made some cuts. They're not doing as, you know, super well. And so you have some parents who are starting to complain about that, saying, well, you know, my kid wanted to get a tuba, but they couldn't get a new tuba for the class, so on and so forth. And so those are the kinds of things that build up and accrue and start to give these parents an idea of, well, what if we took our money and pulled it together? And, you know, here the word to pay attention to is our money. What if we took our money and pulled it together and took it somewhere else and, you know, bought that tuba that we couldn't buy before, because we're no longer subsidizing the poor kids who are having to come to our district and not contributing the money that we expect them to.
I don't know that classism is really any less destructive ultimately than racism, and it's often hard to separate one from the other. But do you have a sense, do scholars studying this phenomenon have the sense that this is more than just class-based, this is about more than money?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's about race. And it's about race, and we know that because in many of these areas, you see parents organizing and using language, racially coded language, to talk about why they want to secede. A good example, I mean, Gardendale is just the perfect example here, because the parents in Gardendale started to complain about Black students being bused into their schools. And they didn't like that. They said that they didn't want other kids from other communities bused into their schools for the sake of integration. And they were under a federal integration order, which is why some Black students were bused into their area. But they didn't want to be subject to that, so that's why they wanted to put that border between them. And when they start talking about, they say, we don't want, you know, poor families to be able to take advantage of our property taxes. But really, when you start to look at the demographics, it's, you know, purely based along racial lines. If you look at a lot of, you know, you don't see a whole bunch of stratified white communities seceding from one another. There's kind of a social contract that people tend to honor in these areas. But especially in very segregated southern districts, you start to see more of the secession talk and more of the secession actions.
And to be clear, you didn't find evidence of Black or Latino families banding together to draw boundary lines to keep white students out of their schools.
No, I didn't. There's an organization that did a lot of this research. They're called EdBuild, and they found that it was predominantly white communities who are banding together. And to be fair, not all of them were seceding for racial reasons or for financial reasons. A lot of them were seceding, not even a lot, a few of them were seceding for legitimate purposes.
But note that San Fernando Valley, whatever happened there was reasonable. What happened there that was different from what happened in Gardendale?
The broad overview is that it was two distinct communities, two distinct financial communities, two distinct social communities, geographic communities that happened to be grouped together into one large district and made for a pretty inefficient system. And so there, the separation made sense. And you can start to look at through the demographics and the median incomes, and you think, okay, well, this makes sense. You look at Gardendale, and the district that wanted to leave, the Gardendale district that wanted to secede, the poverty rate there was 7%. But the district they wanted to leave behind had a 3 times higher poverty rate, a 22% poverty rate, and more than half their students were non-white, whereas Gardendale, the seceding district, less than a quarter were non-white. So there's a very clear demographic pattern to the districts that are seceding for racial reasons. And often, you know, I don't think parents necessarily think that they're doing this for racial reasons, but, you know, it's not necessarily about what the intent is. It's very important to look at the outcomes here and what who suffers because of these outcomes.
My guest is Vox reporter Alvin Chang. You can find a link to his article, School Segregation Didn't Go Away, It Just Evolved, at think.kera.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Vox reporter Alvin Chang about his article, School Segregation Didn't Go Away, It Just Evolved. You can find a link to the piece at think.kera.org. If you want to join us, email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Alvin, maybe this happens differently depending on where in the country it takes place, but do these mini-districts that secede from larger districts, do they get to just take the resources, the buildings, the supplies, the equipment that belonged to the original district, or do they have to pay to take ownership of these things?
So it depends, but often there is some kind of settlement deal. In Gardendale, there is a deal kind of proceeding through the process right now, where one of the high schools, I believe, is located in the district that's seceding. So there's going to be some kind of financial exchange if this thing happens. So there is a financial price. It's almost like a divorce. There's a financial price to pay to leave the existing arrangement and social contract. But oftentimes, you're taking a building that you're going to need anyway, or things you're going to need anyway in your new district, and you're paying a poor district to take that from them, and then basically leaving a district kind of with a small influx of cash, but in very dire circumstances.
Do these newly segregated school districts perform better than they did when they were part of districts that were more diverse?
Yes. But there's something, and you know, this is an argument that the Gardendale organizers made, is they looked at the data and they said, look at all these small districts that are making local decisions for their schools. Look how much better they're doing. The problem there is you're basically taking a group of people who are already, group of students who are already performing better on standardized tests and performing better in school because they have more resources available and better, likely a better family environment, and so on and so forth. And you're pulling them out and you're saying, oh, look how much better they're doing. No, it's just a kind of a matter of simple math and logic that, of course, if you take the cream of the crop as far as resources go and say, well, look, they're doing better, then that's you're going to get the numbers up that way. The problem is the research tends to show that when you start integrating, the scores of the wealthier white students don't actually suffer. They stay the same while all the other students start to catch up. And so the argument that these students are doing better when they've left this larger community is, I think, a hard one to make.
Can you explain this phrase, local control? Because, you know, as we get more and more local with control over public schools, I'll confess that I don't fully understand how different those decisions would be from one neighborhood to the next.
So a lot of people bring up this idea of local control in the spirit of kind of the Jeffersonian idea of local control, that local communities should be able to make decisions for themselves that best cater to their needs. The problem is when these community lines are drawn around areas of privilege. In other words, when you take the people who are doing well and saying, well, let's let those people who are doing well make their own decisions and keep their own resources, and the people who aren't doing well figure it out for themselves, then you start to hit what is kind of a death spiral. So let's say you're in a district and you're, you know, a middle-class person, and the wealthy people in that district start to leave. And all of a sudden, they've taken a lot of resources with them, and you're left in a district that you're not very happy with. And, you know, you start to think, well, you and your friends want to maybe leave as well because they've taken a lot of resources with them, and so you leave as well, and so on and so forth. And you start to kind of cluster into groups based on class, which often tracks along racial lines. And at the end, you have a hyper-local school district where you're not sharing resources with people who are who need it, as you know, who need it. And what's interesting is you could say the same thing about race and this kind of death spiral thing happening where, let's say, you only want to go to a school where a maximum of half the students are non-white. And this is something that researchers have asked of people before and asked, you know, what is the maximum number of non-white people you're willing to live with in your neighborhood or your schools? And, you know, if you said half or so, then let's say, you know, some people have a much lower threshold, they start to leave, and that number starts to drop and drop and drop, and all of a sudden you get that same death spiral effect. And it's something that has been in the research literature for almost 50 years now, of this death spiral of segregation. And it's important to keep in mind how important these social contracts are, to say we're going to have to sacrifice if we're going to live in a larger community, because, you know, at some point you're going to become hyper-localized and no one's going to help you when you're downtrodden, because you're not in a larger community that kind of supports you and has a safety net for you and creates opportunities for you.
So what has changed? You know, there was this massive exodus in the middle of the 20th century after Brown v. Board, a lot of white urbanites moved to suburbs. What has changed now that more families of color have begun to move into those suburbs that were at one time white havens?
So there's been this quiet segregation or self-segregation in these suburbs. So technically Gardendale is a suburb. And as black families started to move around these traditionally white communities, they've started to clam up a little bit. But there's also a trend of some families deciding they want to move further out into what are called exurbs, into non-incorporated areas where they can have, you know, a gated community. And so this, you're starting to see, as people of color are following white families into the suburbs, you're starting to see segregation in the suburbs again. Hmm. And it's really interesting to see the same pattern happening. The same pattern that happened in the city is happening in these suburbs. It's obviously not quite to the same extent as the white flight from after integration, but you're starting to see white families not being as tolerant of, you know, these essentially ethnoburbs, these black suburbs, these Latino suburbs, even these Asian suburbs, where it's very clearly not about the money. It's because a lot of time these Asian suburbs are doing quite well, but white families still won't tolerate a certain threshold. And so, again, we hit that death spiral of certain families saying, well, this is too much for me, I'm going to go. And then that lowers the threshold for everyone else, and so on and so forth, and you start to get this hyper-segregation.
Okay, I'm going to start taking calls here in just a minute. But first, I do want to talk about the effect on property values. What happens if you end up zoned within one of these mini school districts that is, you know, catering to wealthier, whiter students than the broader district, or just outside of it? What happens to the value of your house?
So one of the interesting things about the U.S. is your property values go to your schools, or your property taxes go to your schools. And that means that, so when a school district secedes, the property taxes, they tend to increase property taxes a little bit to pay into it. However, in exchange, what you get is a school district where you are guaranteed to keep a certain amount of your property taxes within a wealthy enclave or an affluent enclave. And so it tends to increase your property values. And so you get this vicious cycle of wanting to put up borders, because then it'll increase your property values, and so on and so forth. And so it's the U.S., the way that we fund schools in the U.S. incentivizes this kind of self-segregation.
All right. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Dave calling us from Fort Worth. Hi, Dave.
Howdy. My question is if you could talk about the idea of whether the choices might have also come about based on, like, noted increases in violence or falling test scores, and perhaps whether the citizens of those communities felt like shrinking the borders of what they consider their district would be an attempt to decrease violence or increase opportunities in the classroom for children to learn?
So the research tends to show that integration, or being in diverse schools, in schools where there is some socioeconomic diversity, being in those schools doesn't hurt the affluent white students. And I think that's it's easy to kind of think, well, if I move over here, then I'm going to be in a school where my kid is going to, you know, somehow get affected by these lower test scores. But really, the evidence doesn't show that to be the case. And I think that's it's counterintuitive. I understand that, because you think, well, I'm looking at these numbers, and this school has a lower test scores, and this school has a slightly higher rate of maybe in-school suspensions or something. But I think we kind of have to keep, at least, you know, for me, I think it's important to keep in mind the biases we bring in about other people and about what the numbers actually mean and what it means for us, as opposed to saying, you know, I want to send my kid to the school with the highest test scores, and I want to send my kid to the school with the lowest amount of violence. I think that's where we really need to think about, okay, what does this mean? What am I actually providing for my child, as opposed to taking away from others?
So at the end of the day, your kid is going to score on a standardized test what your kid is going to score. It doesn't really matter if everybody else is doing a fantastic job with test scores or a really poor job. That's not really going to affect how your child does, right?
Yeah, it tends to be the case. There are thresholds where if you have a certain number of children in poverty in a school and certain amount of concentrated poverty, it starts to affect other students. But, you know, in all these schools, we're talking about very moderate, you know, what are not overwhelming proportions of students in poverty. In the district that is being left behind in Gardendale, it's 22% of students are in poverty. That's high, but it's not enough to reach a threshold where students are going to significantly suffer or even suffer at all. They may actually start to experience new things, broaden horizons, and there's enough research to back that up.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alvin Chang. He's a reporter at Vox who recently published a piece called School Segregation Didn't Go Away, It Just Evolved. You can find a link to it at think.kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Ramus in Dallas. Hi, Ramus.
Hi. I listen to your show every day. Awesome show.
Thank you.
I think that what's happening right now, they are a consequence of two things. Number one, the stupid idea or financing the education through the property taxes, and I'm pretty sure it was some wealthy people, homeowners, who came up with this idea. That way they can corner the money, they can have more control of all the so-called taxes they pay, because they believe that they deserve better schools, better teachers, better football stadiums and all that, because they pay more taxes. And they forget that the parents of those poor students made it possible for them to be wealthy in many ways. And second reason is, it goes back to Reagan. Reagan convinced American people that socialism and communism is the same. Therefore, ever since then, American people rejected any idea of socialism, social programs, or stuff like that. What they've been trying to do these days is this integration and fairly dividing the money among the school districts. It's a socialist type of thing. And American people, especially wealthy ones, reject that.
What do you think, Alvin?
I mean, I think you hit it on the nail. It is silly to be funding our schools with local property taxes. And it's mostly silly because if you think about it, what other public good are we funding with local property taxes and trying to keep? I mean, imagine if we funded medical programs with local property taxes, and there, you know, or Medicaid with local property taxes, that would, and just kept the money within those areas, that would make no sense at all. And so that's, I think that is correct. I think I've seen and heard the word socialism a lot as a potentially or the word being poisoned, and that's why we can't have this conversation of sharing education. I think the word we need to bring back into our vernacular is social contract. And the reason is, we've started to think that we are only responsible for ourselves, and that is very un-American. It is not what this country was founded on. I think we need to start thinking about what responsibilities we have to our fellow neighbors, even if they are not our friends, they are not our acquaintances, they are not people we talk to on a daily basis. But what are our responsibilities toward a community to make sure that everyone has, or that we can work toward a more fair and equal opportunity for their children, for everyone's children, to create opportunities for everyone to have upward mobility. But I don't think that's necessarily something that everyone's thinking about right now. There's going to have to be sacrifice here, because there's going to have to be some amount of value put in being in a community where we have agreed to help others and others have agreed to help us. That's just the way it's going to have to be, or we're going to start to hyper segregate. We're going to start to lose mobility. We're going to start to not understand each other and not have any empathy toward each other. I think that's kind of where it's headed if we don't start to understand that we need to sacrifice a little bit, and we're going to take a little bit when we need it.
Have you met people who say, "I don't care"? I mean, I've been surprised recently to discover how many people don't seem to think that segregation is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who just don't care. A lot of people who feel like it's not their problem because they're doing okay, or they don't have kids in school, or you know, they worked hard for their money and that paid for their schools. So why do I have to deal with this? Again, we have to think about this idea of sacrifice and social contract and why that's important for everyone.
Alvin Chang is my guest. He's a journalist who reports for Vox. He recently published an article called "School Segregation Didn't Go Away, It Just Evolved." You can find a link to it at think.kera.org. If you want to talk to us, call 800-933-5372 or send us a tweet. We're at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Vox reporter Alvin Chang. You can find a link to his illustrated article, "School Segregation Didn't Go Away, It Just Evolved," at think.kera.org. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Alvin, I want to talk about where private schools and charter schools play into this formula. A few years ago, just as an example, the Dallas Independent School District switched to providing free lunch and breakfast for all of its students because the numbers who qualified for free and reduced lunch got up close to 90%. We have our problems here, but that does not reflect the poverty population of this city. So what are parents doing who feel like they don't want to be in the public school system if they can't afford to put their kids in private schools?
So what's interesting about this secession, these secession efforts, are they tend to be parents who are middle class and, as you said, can't afford to send these kids to private schools. And often there aren't good other opt-out options. And so what you're incentivizing is you have middle-class people who feel like their districts aren't good enough or aren't using their resources in a way that they're happy with, and, or sharing with people they don't feel like should get their money, and they are trying to find a way to opt out of that system without having the money for private schools. So essentially, you know, if it really comes down to it, this is another opt-out, an opt-out that doesn't require as much money. It doesn't require $25,000, $30,000 a year, but it is an opt-out. And it's an opt-out that is, I think, more harmful to the community, because when you go to a private school, you still pay property taxes to help educate the children in your area. When you go and create your own district, you're taking your money with you, and you're making the other areas poorer. And so we're now getting to the part of this spiral where you have people who are starting to take their money away from this larger community. And I think it's really important to note, you know, yes, private schools are harmful to public education, but when you have public education starting to benefit and skew toward the more affluent, then that's going to create a system where it hurts poor and people of color significantly more.
And magnet schools are supposed to take talented kids from all over a given district, but in a lot of places there are concerns that these special schools still end up with a disproportionate amount of privileged kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think here in New York is a good example where you have some of the best magnet high schools with predominantly white. I mean, I think it's close to 100% white and Asian children. And, you know, they tend to come from very wealthy families. And, you know, the idea is that there is an opportunity for poor kids, for Black and Latino kids to get into these schools. But really, you're creating filters. You're creating barriers to entry for children who need it most, who need this upward mobility the most. And even with charter schools that require applications, that application doesn't seem like a big deal for a lot of families, but when you're a single mother and you don't know a whole lot about how to navigate the public education system, that application to get into a preferred charter school or even a kind of inter-district magnet school, that application is a huge barrier, and you see it in the numbers. I used to cover some education in Connecticut, and you see it in the numbers where the people who apply for these programs that are supposed to help the poor and the disadvantaged actually don't help them the most. It helps more privileged people more.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. We have Tony calling us from DeSoto. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. How are you doing? Good evening. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Hi.
Yes. I wanted to support this example of the experts in the suburbs. In Dallas, you know, in Oak Cliff, those people are the first people to migrate to DeSoto, City Hill, and Thunderville. Now the banks have moved to those areas. Now they are moving out to the experts too. And most of those school districts are 70% Black. And it's happening right here in Dallas. You see it predominantly in the southern sectors. So, you know, his example is spot on about the experts are people or whites moving to the experts, get away from even the suburb that they once ran to. That's my comment. I'll just not fair.
Thanks for your call, Tony. Yeah, that phenomenon of, you know, inner ring suburbs that were once targets for white flight, now a lot of the white people who moved there, the families and subsequent generations have gone to the exurbs.
And it's interesting. I think the way that we talk about this often is about our individual decisions and I think that's important because, you know, it's important for us to know what the outcomes of our individual decisions are, whether or not we intend the certain consequences, whether or not we intend to take money away from children who need it most. But I think it's also important to keep the other thing in our heads, which is there's a system in place that allows this leakage to take place. There's a system in place that incentivizes people to keep money in their districts, to pour it into their schools, to increase their property values. And so I think if we can keep those two things in our head at the same time, as opposed to saying, well, here's a problem or that's the problem. If we can think there's both a failure of humans and a failure of systems, I think we can have very productive conversations.
Systems, you're talking about state legislatures, the Supreme Court, that sort of thing?
Yep, exactly. The way we fund schools through local property taxes, as well as Milliken v. Bradley, which allows these borders to be put up to hoard in value.
And to be clear, Milliken v. Bradley, this is this 1970 case in Detroit, effectively said If what turned out to be de facto segregation of districts couldn't be demonstrated to be deliberately racially motivated, then those decisions could stand.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So, you know, if you, it essentially made busing between the suburbs and an urban area very difficult, and it made white flight create the kind of segregation that a lot of these families were hoping for, which is predominantly 99% white neighborhoods or 90% white neighborhoods without the fear of being bused into the city.
All right. Let's speak now with Melissa in Fort Worth. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for this topic. It's actually really near and dear to our hearts. My husband is a public school teacher in the district there where we live, and I'm a college professor. We really agonized over the decision about whether or not to put our children in the local public school. We live in a nicely diverse neighborhood. We are middle class, and we love our neighbors and really want our kids to experience kind of the fullness of local community. When we went and visited our local public school, however, we saw really overcrowded classrooms with teachers who are under-resourced. And when I talked with the principal and the teachers, they said, if your child is somebody that is kind of gifted and talented and doesn't really need a lot of support, they're going to do great. And if your child is someone that needs a lot of extra support that we have resources for through the public school, again, we can really support. But it sounds like your kids are kind of those middle-of-the-road kids. And, you know, it's possible that you will see them just kind of falling through the cracks because of the lack of resources and the overcrowding in the classroom. My daughter's kindergarten class was going to be 28, and they had two kindergarten classes, and there was no teacher aide available. What they did was they put two of those classes side by side with a vinyl folding door between them, and when they needed support, they would just open that up so that there would be two teachers now for 56 kids. And I just didn't feel good about that for my kids, and so we opted out and did private school. Talking to other parents in that district, we found out that they actually count on us leaving because they don't have enough classroom spaces for all the children actually in our district. And so if we did show up at our public school, we were putting even more stress on that system. So I appreciate this conversation, and I'm not exactly sure what the right answer is.
That's a really interesting perspective, Melissa. Thanks very much for sharing it. What do you have to say to that, Alvin?
Yeah, I think, you know, Melissa, I appreciate that because it's really difficult. A lot of people who are who understand this topic are having to make these decisions for themselves, for their own kids, and visiting, doing exactly what you're doing, and realizing, well, I have to make this agonizing decision. This is something that I believe in. I want to support public schools, but you know, my kid's going to fall through the cracks here. And I think that's a real concern, and these are decisions that many families are in. In fact, I've had this conversation at least once a week with somebody in the past few weeks. And again, I think if we can keep those two things in our head, there are individual decisions being made that create this system. There are, you know, if all these schools, if these public schools didn't exist, what would happen, right? If these private schools didn't exist, what would happen? We would get an influx of predominantly white, wealthy children into our public schools, and perhaps our state legislators would think, well, you know, this isn't acceptable, or perhaps our local property taxes would increase a little bit to support that. But because we're expecting, these districts are expecting this opt-out, and because it's a failure of the masses or the tragedy of the masses here, you have to make an individual decision in a large scale kind of wave. And what are you going to do? You're going to save yourself, right? And I think that's why we need to both keep in mind the individual decisions as well as the systems that make that possible.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Gabrielle calling us now from Arlington. Hey, Gabrielle.
Hi, thanks for the call, Michael.
Sure.
Mr. King, I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the legality of white communities separating into these independent school districts. I think about that, and I'm kind of baffled as to how it can happen in the first place. I sort of think there has to be someone somewhere along this process, who looks at the proposal and says, this is going to create a huge disparity. You know, we can't let this happen. How is it that, you know, there aren't more, I guess, local groups, or I'm not here at least, that are, you know, sort of working to create laws that will prevent this type of thing from happening and leaving these minority communities behind?
Mm-hmm. So there are, every state has different laws around how to create your own school district. In some states, it's especially easy. You could just, you could pretty much just send in a proposal, meet a few requirements, and you might have a good chance. In other states, it's particularly hard. You have to show, you have to go through a long laundry list of things, including getting the approval of the community that you're leaving. So in a lot of states, you don't have to get the approval of the community you're leaving, which is, I think, a little bit unfair. So, you know, there are checks on the system. In fact, in Alabama, where the Dardingale case happened, the check on the system was supposed to be the federal judge. And the federal judge went through and analyzed a lot of the correspondence that was being had, a lot of the evidence, and she said, yes, the reason that these parents want to secede are for racial reasons. They had racist motives. And she had lots of evidence to show this.
But.
And then at the end of the day, she said, lots. And then she said, but because these parents want to make local decisions, I'm going to let them secede as long as they meet a certain number of requirements. And she had this quote that I've talked to multiple people, and it's kind of puzzling, but she said, isn't it possible that these children and their parents will do more to cure the despicable societal malignancy of racism than an order that drives a wedge in a community and creates new resentments? In other words, isn't it possibly better that we let them secede and then the next generation figures this out versus us forcing this community to stay together, this school district to stay together? And it's you know, especially it rings of this kind of, well, so I guess the thing I want to say is after the Milliken v. Bradley case, Thurgood Marshall wrote in the dissenting opinion, he wrote that school district lines, however innocently drawn, will surely be perceived as fences to separate the races. And then he goes on to say that even though its integration is hard and it looks like it's a hard road ahead, not integrating is going to be a bigger problem. And here we are today, kind of living through his words.
Alvin Chang is a reporter at Vox. You can find a link to his article, School Segregation Didn't Go Away, It Just Evolved, at think.kera.org. Alvin, it's always a pleasure. Thanks again for making time for us.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.